Welcome back to Question Medicine 2019. I'm Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Oh, yes, it is that time again. It is time for another podcast. It is time to dive deep into the literature that I've been reading about. It is time to talk about what I'm reading about, get on what I'm getting through, and maybe discuss a little evidence. So, without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bilt, Question Medicine, 2019, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. If you like this, then you should go check out MRAP. And what if you're saying, listen, I like that you like that MRAP thing, but I'm not an emergency room physician, so what do I got to do with MRAP? Well, they got the new Ride-On Prime in MRAP, which is for primary care. So you're getting eMRAP, you're getting Ride-On Prime, you're getting Crunch Time, which is board review, you're getting all of it for a ridiculously low price. In fact, so low that other companies charge just this much just for one of them, and you're getting everything. If you like this, check that out. If you got some CME money to blow, I would highly recommend it. But of course, I'm biased because I'm in it, and Joe and I are talking about guidelines and all that. But without further ado, let's get to the papers, shall we? Let's kick it off right off the bat. Here we go. The first paper in Lancet, Efficacy and Safety of Statin Therapy in Older People, a meta-analysis of individual participant data from 28 randomized control trials. There is something amazing about individual data. I've talked about it before, but there are some new listeners out there, so let me talk about it again. You see, individual data is awesome, and here's why. You can tease out what really matters. See, let's say there was a drug, and let's call this drug, whiskey. And we survey everyone age 2 years old to 100 years old, and we say, what effect does whiskey have on your life? It could be a good effect, it could be a bad effect, but what effect does this made-up drug that I say whiskey have on your life? And if you combine everyone together, you would find an odds ratio or hazard ratio that there was some effect on people's lives, right? You would find that benefit. But then when you have the individual patient data, you would suddenly find that hopefully that effect on people's lives didn't actually take place from ages 2 to 21. There was no effect there. But when you blended it together with the large effect that we would see between, 21-year-olds and 60-year-olds, then you would say, look at that. There's a huge benefit in this subset of population. And then maybe again, you would see very little benefit or very little effect on the lives between 60 years old and 100 years old. But when you combined them all together, you would say, it works for everyone. This is kind of like the statin therapy, right? Like we mix everyone together, but we know that the benefit really probably isn't there for women, or at least not to the same effect that it is for men. So this study in The Lancet looked to see, are statins beneficial in the elderly? So let's get to some fast fact of the study. This was a meta-analysis of individual participant data on participants who were older or equal to age 75 from 28 large randomized statin trials. Now, in total, this equals only just over 14,000 patients. In those same 28 trials, we had almost 190,000 patients, but only 14,000 are equal to or greater than the age of 75. Absolutely, that's amazing. So you can't necessarily relate the information of general statin therapy to everyone. If you're playing along at home and you're calculating the numbers, let me save you. That's only 7.75% of the population that was in the trials was equal to or greater than age 75. And this is where I could go on a huge long rant about inclusion drift and inclusion criteria and how we need to really look carefully at the studies and how that if you're 75 years old and you're on statin all the time, I mean, we prescribe statins all the time for those 75 years of age and older, but that was only 7% of the trials. We don't really actually know that this necessarily benefits those individuals. And that's what this study set out to find. So let's get to the results. For secondary prevention, i.e. in those individuals that have already had an event, there was a 22% relative risk, not absolute, relative risk reduction in those younger than 75 years old. But in those older than 75, the relative risk reduction dropped to 13%, likely because you're just not living long enough to see the benefit of the drug. And you might be saying to yourself, well, 13%, that's still pretty good, but that's only a 0.5% per year absolute risk reduction, meaning in those of secondary prevention, you would have to treat 200 people to prevent one event. And remember, in some of these trials, one event was hospitalization from chest pain or angina, as they would call it in the studies. So let's go to primary prevention. Remember, these are individuals 75 years and older, primary prevention. They've never had a vascular event before. It should come as no surprise that there was no benefit in the vascular events. There was a small benefit in secondary, but no benefit in vascular events for primary prevention. Now, this should not come as a surprise. We have seen this before in the PROSPER trial back in 2002, which showed benefit in secondary, but not primary for those aged 70 to 72. Also, when you look at the data from the HOPE-3 trial, which was heart outcomes preventative evaluation trial, those individuals greater than age 70 years old, again, no benefit. There is currently a study going on right now, right this very minute in Australia, that looks at those age over 70 years old, 18,000 participants, but we will not have the results of that until 2022. However, I can say at this time, until that study comes out, that statins, at least as I can imagine, are probably like sex. They're better with time. It's better with experience until you've just had too much experience, and then it just kind of messes with your brain and gives you a funky image that you don't want to think about anymore. Ew. Anyways, on to the next article. This next article is a good one because it reminds me that what we do is important. However, what's important or what we focus on may need to change or shift depending on how you're looking at it. This paper is in the New England Journal of Medicine 2019. It's titled Intensive Glucose Control in Patients with Type 2 Diabetes, 15-year follow-up data. In the office, we would like to think that what we do makes a difference, that intensive glucose control really matters, that checking the A1C and getting that blood glucose down is really a big deal, making sure that the hemoglobin molecules are not attaching or glycolating. Oh, it's got to be beneficial, right? And it's got to prevent long-term outcomes. Well, let's get right to some results here. Right off the bat here, Veteran Affairs Diabetes Trial follow-up 15 years later shows there is no benefit 15 years later for those that were randomized to intensive glucose control, A1C 6.9, versus those that were in the standard therapy, A1C 8.4. Now, some of you may remember that there was a slight difference at 10 years, but the A1C was also still a little bit different. Those that were randomized to intense control had maybe taken those habits with them, and the A1C difference was 0.2 to 0.3 difference. It was still in effect. So we couldn't say this is a true legacy effect because the A1C was actually different. Now we have this 15-year data with the primary composite outcome of cardiovascular events. I hate composite outcomes, but let's just look to see what cardiovascular events actually means. It means a non-fatal heart attack, non-fatal stroke, new or worsening congestive heart failure, amputation for ischemic gangrene, or death from cardiovascular causes. There was no difference between the arms. Yes, it did not matter if you were intensive glucose control or more lenient glucose control 15 years later. Now, let's just take a quick history lesson and see what this means for the past and what we can do going forward in the future. You see, the glycemic legacy of if you do intensive control, does it actually matter 10, 15, 20, 30 years later? Has been observed in post-trial follow-up in the DCCT, the UKPDS, but not in the Veterans Affairs, the Accord, or the Advanced trials. So two of them have showed a legacy effect. Three of the trials now have not shown a legacy effect. Why is that? Why is that, you say? I don't have any hard evidence to back this up, but I think it has to do with time. Oh, the tincture of time. You see, the DCCT trial, which again stands for the Diabetes Control and Complications Trial, was released in 1993. The UKPDS trial was released in 1998, and these were conducted 3 decades ago. Yes, 3 decades ago. Some of these were started, actually, these two were started before I was born. And when the use of cardioprotective strategies, such as the antiplatelets, statins, ACE inhibitors, were not standard practice. They were not the norm. But now that they are the norm, it seems to dimmen or diminish or lessen our effect of intensive control. And some of you might be thinking, well, this is terrible news. I mean, we then now don't matter. What we do doesn't matter. But see, that's where you're wrong. What we do does matter. But what we do in the order that we do it is probably what matters. If you're spending all your time trying to get the A1Cs down to a lower number of 6.9, because especially early on, right when they're first diagnosed with diabetes, because you think there's going to be a legacy effect and you think that there's going to be benefit on down the road, well, it appears probably not. You're probably better off spending the entire time talking to your patient about quitting smoking. You're probably better off making sure they're on a statin if they need to be and they meet the high-risk criteria. You're probably better off making sure they have well-controlled blood pressure. You're probably better off doing other preventative measures rather than focusing so heavily on an A1C, even when that A1C, the intensive arm and the standard arm, are a whopping 1.5% different. Remember, 6.9 versus 8.4. Sure, it might make you feel better to have a 6.9, even though that's not in the guidelines anymore. The guidelines now say 7 to 8, but it might make you feel good at 6.9. But what's really making a difference is all the other things that we do, not how low you can get the blood sugar. Now, it might make you feel good to get the blood sugar low, and it might make you feel a little queasy or sick to your stomach to get the vitamin D level low. I know a couple episodes I said, I'm never talking about vitamin D again. But then I read this trial that had to be talked about because the numbers behind it are actually spectacular, depending on how you read the research. Spectacularly good is also the same as spectacularly bad, depending on your perspective. But this study in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Vitamin D Supplements and Prevention of Cancer and Cardiovascular Disease needs to be discussed. You see, this was a randomized placebo-controlled trial. That's pretty awesome. Of vitamin D3, 2,000 international units per day or placebo. There we go again. If you were going to give vitamin D, you would give D3 and you would give 2,000 units. I think almost everyone agrees that if it's going to work, this is where it's going to work. The primary endpoints of this study were invasive cancer of any type and major cardiovascular endpoints, which was a composite of myocardial infarction, stroke, or death from cardiovascular causes. And they followed these individuals up for 5.3 years. This is pretty amazing. Again, you have a composite outcome. So you add a whole bunch of things to try to find something beneficial. This is the key for most cardiac studies, most cardiology studies. You just add a whole bunch of stuff because eventually you add enough stuff, you might find some benefit. So let's look at the numbers, just break it down. I'm not going to go through my whole rant again on vitamin D, but invasive cancer. What was the difference? There was no difference in invasive cancer. Hazard ratio, 0.96. Confidence interval, 0.88 to 1.06. Honestly, no difference at all. What about major cardiovascular events? Yes, what about those? Well, you'll be happy to know that, again, there was absolutely no difference. Hazard ratio, 0.97. That is as close to one as you can almost possibly get because I guess it is kind of placebo. There was not only not a difference in the major cardiovascular events composite outcome, when you broke them down individually, when you looked at each one individually, there was no difference in any of them. Usually you have one that drives the whole thing. You have like 9 outcomes, let's say, and one of them is so positive that it's insane, and then it pulls the rest of them into positivity when you add them all together. But no, in this one, none of them were positive. In fact, they were so not positive, they were so close to zero, if you will, or one, so close to equal. Vitamin D was so close to placebo as being an equal. When you look at the analysis for death from any cause, the hazard ratio was 0.99. That doesn't get any closer to one for a hazard ratio that there is. It is basically placebo. And there was also no difference in excess risk compared to placebo. Now, this should make complete sense because a drug without a side effect is a drug without an effect. And that, I think, sums it up nicely and should take us on to the next article. This next one might be my last one because, as I can see, we're getting close to 20 minutes and the Better Brand and I need to catch a plane. So, here we go. The next one is kind of an article, but kind of an approval and kind of a questioning medicine at its prime, if you will. And the question is, why in the world did the FDA approve this drug? Or maybe should I say that the way that they approve this drug, the media hype that this drug is going to get, doesn't do what you think it's going to do. And the drug that I'm talking about, of course, is Vileese. I could totally be slaughtering that. V-Y-L-E-E-S-I. Vileese? I have no idea. That's the trade name. The generic name is bremelanotide. Anyways, the name of the drug isn't that important because it doesn't work quite like we think it's going to work. So let's go in and deep dive into the article, into the research that was presented to the FDA and made them approve this drug. And then you can think to yourself, would this be a drug that I would approve? Well, I'm going to tread lightly through this drug because I know that the reason it was approved is a real condition. And I am sure there are real people out there who suffer from this real condition. However, I just don't know any of them. The condition is hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which is considered a sexual dysfunction and characterized as a lack or absence of sexual fantasies and desire for sexual activity as judged by a clinician. Again, there are all sorts of jokes here that could be played on different sexual preferences of the different male and female genders, but I'm going to let those be, and I will let you ponder them in your mind while I talk about the DSM criteria. See, the DSM criteria are symptoms must persist for at least 6 months. They have to cause clinically significant distress and not be better explained by any other condition. Simply having a lower desire then one's partner is not a sufficient diagnosis, because as you can imagine, every single couple in America would suffer from this, as I think there is always one partner that's more sexually intrigued at one point or another. In fact, I think every person would suffer from this at one point or another. So the FDA then approved this drug, Vileese, or bremelanotide. Which is great, right? This is a drug that's going to make you so horny, baby, yeah. Kind of like Austin Powers. I know that was not a good impression, but you know what I'm talking about. This is a drug that's going to make you want to have sex. Regardless if you suffer from the condition or not, you will want to have sex. And if that was true, there would be couples everywhere looking for this medication. So let's get into the fast facts of this trial. In this 24-week randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, there was two of them. And in total, there were just over 1,200 premenopausal women, and they were tested to find out, did it improve their sexual desire? And yes, it improved their sexual desire. In fact, 25% of patients on Vileese had an increase of 1.2 or more in their sexual desire score. That's got to be awesome, right? Because the score range was 1.2 to 6, with higher scores indicating greater sexual desire. So basically, you had a 5-point difference in scale, and you went up 1.2, or a change of about 1.2. On a 5-point scale, that's a 24% difference. You're 24% more horny. Oh, yeah, that's got to be awesome. Except for the placebo, a sugar pill, if you will, made patients 17% more horny, or have a 17% greater sexual desire. But if you just read the article, that is a number needed to treat of 13 for a 1.2-point difference on a 6-point scale for sexual desire. Notice I just said they had more sexual desire. I didn't say they had more sex, because when you actually look at the study, there was no difference between groups in the number of satisfying sexual events. And they even say on their advertisement, although the drug reps may never tell you this, Vileese does not enhance sexual performance. I don't have the disease or the disorder. I'm sure it is real, and I'm sure there are real people who suffer from it. But I cannot believe that this drug got passed on that endpoint to actually be prescribed for patients. When placebo makes you 17% more horny or more sexually desired, and a very expensive drug only makes you 24% more sexually desired or horny. I'm just not sure that this is probably going to be worth the $100 or $200 or however many $100 price tag that's going to be placed on it. And with that, let's wrap this one up like we've ended every one before it. Here we go.
Let's see if I can do this in 30 seconds or less. If you are 70 years old or 75 years old, if basically you're over the age of what we consider elderly, then statins probably have no benefit for primary prevention because you're not going to live long enough to see the benefit. And secondary benefit is very small and should be considered maybe not do it. There is more evidence coming on this, but not for a couple years. If you have a patient that has diabetes, and don't we all, then you should get the glucose down. But you should only get the glucose down after you max out their other cardiovascular risk factors. Intensive glucose control does not have a legacy effect. So get them to quit smoking. That's probably better for them. And vitamin D. Oh, vitamin D. It does not beat placebo for anything, ever, except for the lab value. It definitely beats placebo on the lab value. However, do we really care about the lab value? And last but not least, Vyleesi or bremelanotide will make you have more sexual desire on a sexual desire scale, but you won't have more sex. I still can't believe the FDA approved this one, but maybe I could make a drug that gets a terrible surrogate marker to improve and then also make $1 million as a drug company. Ugh, the frustration. But that wraps this one up. This is right about 20 minutes, so let's end it. Wait for the music. Yep, there it is, there it is. Here we go. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.